This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Economist Richard Layard has identified a curious paradox. Even though the standard of living has more than doubled compared with 50 years ago, people aren't any happier. Now, economists don't typically worry whether their fiscal policies will make people happy, but in his new book, Happiness: Lessons from a New Science, Layard argues they should. What's the point of acquiring all that wealth if people aren't enjoying it? In this hour, we'll explore the factors that make people happy, and what we can do, both individually and as a society, to be happier. A little later in the program, Nazi war criminals and the CIA. But first this hour, we want to hear your thoughts about happiness. Has making more money increased your happiness? Do you think richer people are happier than the less well-off? And should happiness be a goal of public policy? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Richard Layard joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hello. So, you know, your book has got some very interesting claims in it, but let's start off with the very first one, and that's this notion that people may be, or society may be, richer today, but they're not happier. So, first of all, how do we know that?
We have surveys where people have been asked how happy they are. Going back to the 1950s, we have that in the States, in Britain, in Japan. There's no movement in the answers except up and down over the business cycle. Now, you might say that people are using words differently, but if you take the same people over time, most people over their lives become very much richer. They don't report being any happier. And of course, at the level of our society, we have data on, for example, depression, which is going up, or certainly not going down. We have data also on crime, which of course is a lot higher than it was in the early 50s. That's another indicator of discontent. So we can be pretty sure, I think, that these results mean something, on top of which, if you doubt whether we can know what other people feel, we have the neuroscience now, which shows that when somebody says they're happy, there's something happening in their brain which we can measure, and the movements of the brain are very well correlated with the way in which people report their happiness, which I think overcomes the old canard that you can't know what other people are feeling.
Right. But I'm just curious now. I just want to make sure that I understand something. You're not saying that happiness is necessarily the flip side of depression. In other words, are you? Maybe I should ask that.
No, I think there are many factors that contribute to happiness. Relationships, of course, are the most important thing. Income, if it raises your position relative to other people, can also make you feel better. There are many factors, of course, producing unhappiness, bad events in your life, or a difficult character, or a proneness to mental illness. These are very negative factors for people. But what I'm claiming is this, and I think this is a really important finding from neuroscience, that we can identify areas in the left front of the brain where people experience good feeling, and on the right front of the brain where they experience bad feeling. These two experiences are very strongly correlated in a negative sense with each other, so that if you're feeling good, you can't be feeling bad, and vice versa. So we can claim that we have a single dimension of our experience all the time, which is how good or bad we are feeling. And this, of course, was the idea that Jeremy Bentham, the philosopher who produced the idea of the greatest happiness as the objective for society, this is the idea he had in mind, that happiness is something which reaches from extreme misery to extreme joy and contentment, and that we should be, as a society, trying to make it possible for people to achieve as much as possible of happiness. And also, of course, he said that our job as individuals was to spread happiness around. The right thing we should be doing is trying to produce the greatest happiness of all the people who are affected by our decisions.
Now, Bentham was an 18th century, I guess you'd call him a philosopher, right?
Correct.
But how seriously do people take this notion of, you know, a society that's bent on, or a group that's bent on improving the happiness of its members? Certainly, you don't think of economists as being in that position to take those kinds of things into account.
Well, when you say people, of course, people who wrote the American Constitution had that idea very much in mind. And when economics was founded in the early 19th century, it was, or let's say even in the 18th century by Adam Smith, it was thought of as being a way of thinking about what kind of economic arrangements would make for a life in which people were happy. What went wrong, actually, was in the 20th century, when psychologists first and then economists came to believe that you couldn't know how happy people were. Mm. And therefore they fell back on a very peculiar idea, which was that you couldn't say anything about whether a person was happy, but you could infer that they must be happier if they had a higher level of purchasing power, meaning if there was more that they could exchange with other people for their mutual advantage. And that became the basis, of course, of the measurement use of the GNP, the gross national product, as a measure of national welfare, which is now competed for, of course. There's a kind of league stakes around the world, right, in this, whereas the league stakes, of course, should be in whether we have happy or unhappy societies.
League stakes is not a word we use in this country, but I think you mean a sort of a goal to be attained, as it were.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Good. I just want to make sure that the audience doesn't lose us with that bit of...
Let me say, yeah, when the G7 heads of state, mm-hmm, and prime ministers meet together, they're very, very conscious of which of them has got the highest gross national product per,
sure,
head, and we know who the answer is there.
Yeah. But here's the thing. If I walk up to my producer right now and I say, JJ, here's $100, I'm going to make him happy. Right? He just acknowledged that to me. So,
right.
Where does it break down that this spending power doesn't translate into greater happiness? I mean, where does it break down?
Oh, well, I think there's a basic reconciliation between these two paradoxically different facts, that countries don't get happier when they get richer and individuals do. And the answer is that the individuals are comparing their income with the income of other people. So if one individual gets happier while everybody else stays put, if one individual gets richer while everybody else stays put, that individual gets to be happier. But of course, as a country experiences increasing income over time, everybody is rising up together, and it's impossible for everybody to rise relative to everybody else. And that's why it's so difficult to make a society as a whole happier by becoming richer.
Interesting. All right, well, let's hear what our callers have to say. First, let's go to John in Grand Junction, Colorado. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, great show.
Thank you.
I just want to say that I had a job. I was making almost twice what I'm making now, and I left it to move to Grand Junction to do what I always wanted to do. And I'm much happier. And boy, I'll never forget when I announced at my workplace that I was leaving in Los Angeles. People came out of the woodwork and told me stories of how frustrated they were in their job, and they couldn't believe somebody was finally getting out to do what they wanted to do. And, you know, I think there's a lot in our culture that really works against following your bliss and doing what you want to do, and there are a lot of people out there, I think, that are pretty frustrated. And so for me, capital, money, at least in this culture, seems to push against it. And you have to know how to push back, or you have to kind of jump off the side of the cliff to go for it.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point, John, because Richard Layard, in your book, you talk about extracting yourself from the rat race, and it sounds like that's one of the keys to happiness.
I think that is another way of putting the issue. If people are basically always worried about how they compare with other people, you basically have a situation where, you know, there's somebody's first, somebody's second, third, fourth, fifth in income or whatever else it is. And everybody's trying to climb up that rank order. But, of course, every time one person climbs up, somebody else climbs down. And the average doesn't change. So that there can't be any net gain from that kind of a scramble. And what people should be doing is thinking, what are the things that satisfy themselves, satisfy them because of their intrinsic quality rather than because of the way they compare with other people. And those things are, of course, whether the work is satisfying and meaningful, but also, of course, whether you're able to give time to your private life, to your family relationships, to your friends, and so on, which we know to be things which are satisfying in themselves rather than in this comparative rat race kind of way.
John, thanks very much for that call. Let's take another quick call from Nathaniel in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Nathaniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to observe, I had an interesting experience in the 90s. I was the founder of a dot-com company, more for the challenge of it than the money, and I got I became a millionaire for a couple of years and then lost it all in the dot-com crash. And my observation was that although it was kind of fun doing things I couldn't do before with the money, the money didn't really add that much to my happiness, but losing it took away significantly from my happiness. It seems like there's more pain from losing the money than pleasure from gaining it.
Nathaniel, I'm suspicious that you've already read Richard Layard's book because I have a feeling he's going to have a lot to say on that point. But before I let him get to the answer, we're going to take a quick break. So please stay on the line, Nathaniel, and Richard Layard, stay in the studio, of course. And we'll talk more about happiness after a short break. We'll take more of your calls. If you've traveled around the world or around this country, do people seem happier in some places than others? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Our topic this hour is happiness. Our guest is Richard Layard, whose new book is called Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. And we were just listening to Nathaniel in Ann Arbor, who described his experience of making $1 million in a dot-com company and then losing it subsequently in the dot-com bust, and the pain of loss being greater than the happiness that having the money brought him, and I think that's a perfect entree to something Richard Layard talks about in his book. So tell us why that is, or how you perceive why that seems to be the case.
Well, that is, of course, a basic psychological fact, which in the jargon is called loss aversion. Daniel Kahneman, who's the first psychologist to win the Economics Nobel Prize, said a lot about that. Roughly speaking, if you gain £100, the gain in happiness is a half the pain if you lose £100.
See, now I have I'll translate to dollars.
You translate to dollars.
So that would be $160 or so if you gained it and losing $160. That's okay. I just want to make clear we were not talking about the pain of gaining weight, which Americans might do.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that is basically why people are so keen on security. And it applies to things other than income as well, of course. And I think that we ought, as a society, to respect security more than we do. There's the idea that everybody should be taking risks all the time, but actually it's perfectly natural for human beings to want security, and we ought to have social security systems which make people feel secure in prospect of their old age without having too much to worry about, and so on. Having said that, I do want to say that the best thing in life is not just to lie down on your back and feel secure. It is to be trying to achieve something. And the trick is, of course, to have a goal which is sufficiently challenging but attainable. And I think one of the real problems in life, maybe it's actually wired to some extent into our genes, but we have to try and counter that. One of the problems in life is that people are pushing themselves so hard that they almost get into a position where there's only two possible outcomes. One, they will just achieve the goal, or otherwise they'll fail. And that's no way to live. You ought to be living in a way where you're just as likely to exceed your goal, or even more so, than to fail in it. Now that we are away from the basic struggle for survival in a physical sense, we don't need to have those genes that are constantly pushing us on to the limit. We need to use our reason to choose a lifestyle which actually makes us as happy as possible.
Nathaniel, I hope that all made some sense to you.
Yeah, it does. I think that's part of it. I think another thing that's relevant is just what we become dependent on. You know, when I made the money, I started helping various friends and relatives who became somewhat dependent, and turning that off was rather harder than you know, doing without a new gadget or whatever. Hmm. I think one conditions one's expectations, and it's hard to disappoint people.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, Richard Layard, what do you make of that point?
I think that's true. I think it's always been known that one of the problems of, for example, winning the lottery is the claims that other people start exerting on you. And if you can't then live up to them, things are worse than otherwise. And also, of course, there's always the danger with income that people will be loving you for that and not for who you are.
You know, you mentioned Daniel Kahneman's work, and I think if I understand that properly, I mean, the idea is that, as you were saying, $100, we'll say, loss is more painful than $100 gain is rewarding. It seemed to me that what Kahneman was saying was economists don't always think in those terms, and that seems to me, it's interesting, a psychologist wins an economics prize, because a psychologist is saying you can't look at two things that are financially equivalent. In other words, 100 up or 100 down are, you know, the same, it's just the direction is different, the magnitude is the same, but they're not really the same in the way people perceive them. And it seems to me that's at the heart of some of the things your book is trying to remind people about.
Well, I think that one of the problems with economics is that it hasn't learned enough from psychology. This loss aversion thing is one. Social comparisons that we were talking about earlier is another very important piece of human psychology, which is not really properly reflected in economics. Another really important issue is habituation, that we get used to things. And, of course, one reason why we are not that much happier from having all those extra gadgets, space, etc., is that we rather quickly get used to it. And we didn't always foresee that was what was going to happen. So we, as it were, put an excessive effort into getting a bigger house or a bigger car. We then took on the mortgage debt or whatever it was, which we then had to service. We ended up not that much happier from the bigger house, and with as much financial pressure as we ever had. And one of the most depressing things, just to sort of ram home what I was saying at the beginning, one of the most depressing things is people have been asked for the last 50 years, how satisfied are you with your financial position? Mm-hmm. Now, people, almost all groups in society, are at least twice as well off in real terms now as they were 50 years ago. And yet there is no increase in people's satisfaction with their financial situation. That is a terrible indictment in a way, isn't it?
It is a little discouraging. I think you're right. Let's take another call. This time, let's go to Jennifer in Lagunitas, California. Did I say that right, Jennifer?
Yes, you did. Thanks
Good.
For taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your question?
I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
I just returned from traveling in the rural parts of Mexico and Central America, and I definitely noticed what you're talking about, where these folks have so much extreme difference in ownership than what we have. And yet they're still much more satisfied and happy, and I'm sure it does have to do with free time. But also it seems like the challenge of surviving through hard work and makes them more beautiful physically and mentally. And I wanted to know if you found any in your research cultures that are happy and how they're structured economically and how we can restructure our society. Because, of course, the crux is that we are utilizing more resources than our share in this planet, and how we could restructure them to give everyone more of a fair share.
Interesting. What about that?
Well, I think it's possible to over-idealize the less advanced cultures in the world. And we've got something called the World Value Survey, which has been done four times now, where people in countries from the very richest to the very poorest have been asked the same questions about how happy they are. And the general finding is this, that amongst the more advanced countries, above, say, $20,000 a head average, which includes most of the old European countries, North American countries, there is no clear relation between the average income of the country and the average happiness. But when you go to the poorer countries, you certainly find lower levels of average happiness. And you also find this, which I think is very interesting, that whereas in our society, to be at the top end of the income distribution makes you a bit happier than being at the bottom end, but not a whole lot. In these really poor countries, extra income makes a hell of a difference. And the reason, of course, is that you're living right up against nature. You're in an extremely dangerous situation, often where you're dependent on the weather and so on. And the average that you can expect is also very, very low and hard. And the kind of work you have to do is extremely grinding. And I don't think we should underestimate the value of having got rid of drudgery. But what I think we should reflect on is how we take advantage of our extra income. And I think that kind of what has gone wrong is that we've felt it necessary just to get more and more and more income, often just for the sake of being able to say we have it, not even because we really can think of how to spend it, rather than thinking seriously about what would make for a good life, which is engagement with other people. We're deeply social beings. And we get our greatest satisfaction, or some of our greatest satisfaction, from helping other people. And I think that what has really gone wrong in our society is the system of values, which has said almost that your greatest moral obligation is to make the most of yourself. I think that's a terrible philosophy for somebody to have. It puts a terrible strain on them because they feel under this enormous internal pressure all the time. Whereas I think more satisfaction is got from thinking that you're contributing to the good of others. That's also good for the others. And I think we'd have a much better society if we did actually adopt the idea of making as much happiness in the world as the thing which makes sense to people's lives. That's the reason for living, is to create happiness in other people and in yourself.
I'm listening to you, and I'm just wondering if it isn't, I mean, a little bit utopian, because the argument I've also heard is what drives the U.S. economy and pushes it hard so far forward is the entrepreneurial spirit, which isn't saying I'm going to drive to become happier, but I'm going to drive to build the better mousetrap or open the company that does these great things. And it's that spirit that drives the country forward. So, you know, what happens absent that? You know, if everybody's just saying, oh, well, I don't want to push too hard because that'll make me, make somebody else unhappy.
Well, the economy is not a person. Mm-hmm. It's often talked about as if it's a person, and kind of you owe it to the economy to work yourself into the ground. And there's a very simple confusion around in much of the discussion. If you ask yourself or other people, why should we work hard? The answer they will give is because we owe it either to the economy, or if they're a bit more thoughtful, they'll say to the consumers. The consumers, be it of objects that they buy or services that they get, the consumers deserve a good, more products, better services. But the fallacy with that, of course, is that the consumers are the same people as these workers. And the trick is, obviously, to balance our own interests as consumers against our own interests as workers. And this is why something has gone wrong at many workplaces where people have been subjected to increasing stress in the name of the consumer, where they themselves, as worker consumers, are actually becoming more and more frazzled because of the pressure that they're put under. And I think that the appeal to the economy has to be turned back into human terms. Who is the economy? It's the consumers and the workers. Those are the same people. What is the right work-life balance? Which, of course, differs between people, and we should let people who want to work really hard, of course they should, and if they find satisfaction in their work, that's another reason for working really hard. I'm totally opposed to, for example, in France, where they put a limit on how long you can work. I'm absolutely against that. But I think that the culture which is justifying extreme levels of stress at work in the interests of consumers, that needs some rethinking.
Mandating leisure does seem to have a strange tone to it. But anyway,
exactly.
We're talking with Richard Layard, the author of Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now. How about if we go to Jamie, who's on the road in Louisiana. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm on the road, and I might go through a blind spot where we cut out, so
okay.
I apologize in advance.
All right, well, we'll hope
I'm from New Orleans, and I work in Baton Rouge. I suffered, and I mean suffered, many years of underemployment and unemployment, although I'm well-educated, and the deep, deep misery, and it's profound, and it's all over in New Orleans because there are many poor people in New Orleans. And I was wondering if you addressed that. There are so many people that have too much work and so many people that don't have work. And eventually you get stuck in a self-defeated spiral because you try and you try and you get defeated and your self-esteem is blown, you know?
Okay. Hey, Jamie, it's a good point, and I know Richard Layard has something to say about it, so we'll let you go back to taking care of your driving and listen to his answer.
Yeah, one of the most clear findings of happiness research, it comes every time, is how awful unemployment is for people. It comes through as being almost as bad as being divorced, because you cease to be needed in both cases, and that's one of the deepest human needs, is the need to be needed. So I totally agree with you. Now, how do we deal with the unemployment problem? That actually is what I spent most of my life working on. And one thing is clear, is that this sort of simple image that there's so much work to be done and we can either have a little less work for each person and more people in work or otherwise, that's completely wrong. There's not a fixed amount of work to be done, but we can get full employment by giving proper help to people in developing their skills, proper help to people in finding work, giving incentives to employers to give workers who've got in real difficulty a chance. I believe that the European method of, in the last resort, providing some kind of activity for a person in which he can regain his self-respect is also a very, very good approach to this. So I totally agree with you. This is a central issue in any society that we should make sure everybody who wants to work can work.
Is it clear that countries that do allow that are happier? Has that been documented?
Yeah, there's a very, very interesting study by a Canadian economist called John Halliwell, where he tries to explain the difference in average happiness between all those countries that I mentioned to you before. And the unemployment rate comes through as a very, very important factor.
All right. Well, when we come back from a short break, we'll wrap up our conversation about happiness with Richard Layard. Then we'll talk about a campaign to release documents detailing ties between former Nazis and the CIA. Please call us if you have questions about that. Our number again is 800-989-8255, or you can send us an email, totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation with British economist Richard Layard, author of a new book about happiness. And I want to read quickly from an email that's sent by David, who looks like is, if not in England at the moment, at least lives there most of the time, because his phone numbers all begin with the country code 44. But he quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson, "The purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well." And I'm not sure, Richard Layard, that that would actually that would be at so much at odds. I would imagine that happiness would tend to fall out of a life that would be a logical consequence of a life that was lived that way.
Well, absolutely. There's a bit of a confusion over this. I mean, if I say happiness matters, I mean everybody's happiness matters. I don't mean that the right way to live is to just try and be happy yourself. The right way to live is as if everybody's happiness mattered, which means contributing as much as possible to other people's happiness while having sensible regard to your own. So I think that the proper humanistic approach is to think that feelings matter more than kind of objective reality like money or even throughput through some form of social service or whatever. It's what people feel. We often pay far too little attention to people's feelings as compared with the supposed objective of the enterprise, the hospital, or whatever it is. It's quite interesting. I'll tell you that the Canadians have decided to judge their hospitals very seriously by how satisfied their patients are. And it turned out that the patients consider it just as important how well they're spoken to and whether people treat them as human beings as whether they cure them. So we're trying to build that kind of a society rather than the one which has outputs and inputs, and we just try and do everything in the name of inputs. We should be interested in the processes by which we live, and I think that Emerson would have agreed with that. Can I just throw in one last thought?
Oh, absolutely.
If you ask who are the most miserable people in society, and that is one of the things that this way of thinking should focus our minds on, of course, the biggest single cause of misery in our society is mental illness. And this is the great unspoken thing in most families' lives. You know, a third of us will have a serious mental illness sometime in our life. Half the families will have mental illness as a serious problem at some time. And yet this is not spoken of because it's thought of as a source of shame. And I really hope that if we can get people talking about happiness as the thing that we're trying to produce in our society, we will get much more resources and much more prestige attached to psychiatry and the evidence-based psychological therapies which can make people have better lives.
We have time for one more quick call. Leslie in Elkhart, Indiana, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. You've pretty much been covering all the points I wanted to point out. I wanted to bring up the Declaration of Independence that we founded our society on, states, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as being primary human rights. And but that we have developed like a consumer society, and in a consumer society, who consumes the most wins. And that puts us at odds with the basic philosophical belief of when you have enough wealth, that's good, but when you have too much, it's wasteful, it's greedy, and it hurts the rest of the society that doesn't have enough. So having our society built on pursuing happiness but measuring it with wealth makes it a bad combination.
Leslie, thanks for the call. Richard Layard, is there a hope that people will take this all to heart, do you think? Have you been getting a good reception for your book, from your book?
I've had a very good reception from the British government, and there's a big movement in the States of people who want to replace the gross national product as the measure of how well the States is doing as a society by what they call happiness accounts. And these would really monitor closely what is happening to the quality of lives of people in all the different walks of life. And, of course, it would also draw our attention to what I was saying before. Where are the real problems in life rather than some of the supposed problems, which may not be as serious? The real problems are where people are in real misery.
Well, thank you very much for this interesting discussion. Richard Layard's new book is called Happiness: Lessons from a New Science. He spoke to us from our bureau in New York.